everyone. Welcome to the Inspired by Tweets podcast. My name is Ilsa Ida, and with me is...
Ahmed Rufaisa. Thank you for joining us. As you know, today, obviously, we wanted to start this podcast by celebrating our mothers. Mother's Day just, you know, went by yesterday. I wanted to take the first part of this episode to celebrate mothers. I'm sure everyone loves their mother. Mothers are incredible pillars of all our lives. They are why we are here for the most part. And they are why most of us are who we are today. And so we wanted to start by wishing every mother out there a very wonderful Mother's Day celebration. It's not just a one-day thing, obviously. Mothers are continuously celebrated on a daily basis. And so I advise that, you know, everyone take the time to celebrate their parents, celebrate their moms especially, and make sure that, you know, they've had a good day, they're having a good week, and they're having a good time as always. So, Elsa, it seems like you have a very good mother song cue for us, and I'm interested in listening to it.
So, you know, to celebrate our mummies, you know, I decided that I'm going to share my beautiful voice with the world. So please clap for me as I, but never mind. Yes, I just wanted to sing this this song. This is originally a poem by Ann Taylor, which I'm sure everybody knows. And then one other one in Yoruba, but I'll be real quick about it because Rufa is going to be giving me the side eye. So, who sat and watched my infant head when sleeping on a cradle bed and tears of sweet affection shed? My mother, who taught my infant lips to pray and love God's holy book and stay and walk in wisdom's pleasant way. My mother, I know the thought I cannot bear, and if God please my life to spare, I hope I shall reward thy care. My mother. So that's the first part of my song. And I just found out that Rufa's wife is Yoruba, so he has to listen to this Yoruba song as well. Oh.
You have to bring that up. Okay. Let's hear your second song.
That's my blog. Anyway, the second one is Iya ni wura iye piye. Ti akole fowora. Iya ni wura iye piye. Ti akole fowora. O lo yu mi foshu mesan. O kwa mi fodu meta. Iya ni wura iye piye. Ti akole fowora. Yay! And I'm done.
Awesome. Let me give you a really wonderful clap. That was beautiful.
I think that's why my key didn't go higher, because, you know, usually I can sing an octave higher than that. Yeah.
I know nothing about the technical part of singing. So I'm just going to ask you to, for the Yoruba song, obviously tell us what Yani Wora means.
I admit that I do not have complete understanding of the Yoruba language, but I suppose that it means that Yani Wura, I think a mother is a pearl, or she's a jewel, one of those, and she's a jewel forever. And, you know, she carried me for 9 months and also backed me for 3 years or something. And she's a person that you cannot purchase with money or something like that. Well, that's rough translation. Hopefully, people that are, you know, pro Yoruba people might interpret it a bit better. But yes.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you very much. I think that's really wonderful. That's really wonderful. Okay. I think right now we'd like to talk about something that, you know, since we started this podcast has been obviously part of the conversation we've always wanted to have, which is social media, social justice and social media. As we all know, the technology has kind of taken over the world, and social media has become our major tools of communication, whether about our individual lives, our jobs, our frustrations, our excitements, our interests, and so also social justice. And with the age of social media, we want to really look at how social justice is playing out, especially how social media is either aiding the push for social justice by individuals or organizations or government or just groups of people. And we wanted to sort of delve into how that looks like on social media as well. And I think this is why we think that this is an important topic. And Elsa, I want to hear what you have to say.
So social justice, social media and social justice is, so the odds are that everyone has encountered a social media campaign with a social cause, you know, and there's a Pew research from, I think, 2018, you know, that was saying that more than half of, I think, Americans, you know, that were involved in a survey had revealed that they've been involved in the fight for social justice through a social media campaign at one point or the other. I guess that could also apply to other countries around the world. I mean, at its core, I think social media activism is a form of protest or advocacy, you know, that just uses social media channels. Hashtag plays a central role in mobilizing movements. And sometimes, you know, they're just used interchangeably with hashtag activism. They promote awareness, they show solidarity to causes, and, you know, many of those causes and activism, they're supported by concrete actions, donations, and measurable commitments to change. Now, here's what people have to realize with that, is that people usually have a bigger sphere of influence than they realize. When people are tweeting, you know, for example, let's use Twitter. When people are tweeting, they just think that, you know, they're reaching out to their immediate circle of friends or some people they just met online that they're cool with. But, you know, research keeps showing that that this is not correct. You know, the ideas and behaviors, you know, ripple out from under you. They influence your friends. They influence the friend of your friends, some of whom you may not even know, and friends of those friends as well, because fundamentally, human beings are social species. Yeah. It's such an integral part of us now, because with life and with journey and with history, you'll find that for every change, for every century, for every, you know, stage, you know, there's always some sort of activism. And then for us to now be interconnected with channels like this, it was just a matter of time for them to become one. And since it's become a mainstay and an integral part of who we are as a people, social activism has come to stay. We see the stuff through Black Lives Matter, the ALS Bucket Challenge, you know, Arewa Me Too, Church Me Too, and, you know, just different things, you know. And they play a part in or an instrumental role in mobilizing human rights movements offline. So I think it's such an important and powerful phenomenon, I guess, and just to even say that it's bigger than individuals these days, brands are now participating in these kinds of things as well. I remember when Nike did, I think it was a video, I recollect, in support of Colin Kaepernick, and, you know, a lot of companies, you know, stood up during the Black Lives Matter as well. You know, just, you know, it's gone from being individual. It's almost like a whole organic thing that is either you're part of it, you know, or you, if you're not counted to be a part of it, then, you know, you're definitely going to be counted out. But please, before I start preaching, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that in a way, what we have seen is social media giving social justice a platform. And essentially, that means giving the people behind those issues a platform. And yeah, in different ways, social media uplifts people's voices and kind of presents their stories to the world, to more audiences, in a way that says, you know, this is happening here and you need to know about this. Even when you are not interested in these issues, they come to you anyway. So this is, I think, one of the ways in which social media has helped in uplifting stories. Also, people tend to use social media to create awareness about the issues that they are having. And I go all the way back to the Ice Bucket Challenge, where people were trying to raise funds for. This is way before the Arab Spring, and globally, yeah, people were pouring ice on themselves to kind of raise awareness about a certain issue and, you know, generating money to fund it. All the way to the Arab Spring, to the Black Lives Matter, until this day. And even at a micro level, your social media has kind of created a tool, or presents itself as a tool, all the platforms where people can meet communities, people they share interest with. So if I'm interested in the issues of people, let's say, living with certain conditions, and I'm interested in making sure that their voices get heard, just coming on different social media platforms kind of presents me with an opportunity to meet a community of other people who are interested in those kind of things. And so it creates space for individuals, organizations, activists to demand that, you know, the kind of justice, or demand the voice of people, or demand some certain response from government. And in other way, I think that one thing we are seeing is, over time, social media has become a coordinating ground for, you know, actively seeking for justice in different spaces. And what I'm saying is, before now, people organize, you know, protest movements, all kinds of, you know, activism, just by knocking on doors and reaching out to people, or they happen organically, that everyone is angry about a certain situation, and they've always been a designated place for activists to show up. But now you see the platform serving as a place where people discuss what the issue is, and then agree on, you know, their response to the issue, and also coming together to maybe speak about it, or reach out to people, reach out to stakeholders, or engage some certain members of parliament or government officials to that effect. And I think that role of coordination as a space for coordination has, you know, really been very vital. And I think social media also, you know, is platforming lived experience of people. I give a very recent example is obviously the very touching NSAS stories that we heard from different people. And these are issues that have happened way before some of these tools were created, and they had no platform of expression. So essentially, those experiences that have already, people have lived already, kind of found platform in the current age because of these tools. And so it's really interesting to see how this is happening. And we obviously know about the way that images, multimedia, sound, and are being used to raise people's consciousness on these issues. Yeah.
Absolutely. I think you said everything. I mean, especially the last part where you touched on using sound, images, you know, whether it's design or just even using photography. you know, videography, you know, just all sorts of things, you know, to paint a more accurate image of some of the struggles that many of these people are facing. And, you know, like you said, many of even the issues that people are agitating against are as old as 30, 40 years. I mean, stuff around rape or, you know, sexual assault in the workplace, you know, there's just a lot of stuff. And of course, the stuff with the SARS officials, especially in Nigeria as well. It's amazing what social media has been able to do for justice. It's important to note and probably to distinguish at this point that, you know, for people that participate in some of these challenges, you know, you need to find out the origin of the campaign. What is it really about? You understand the strategy behind it. So yeah. You just don't jump into something, you know, and then you cause chaos around it, you know. And if it's a campaign that has calls to action, such as raise money or collect signatures or attend an event, or, you know, hold an elected official accountable.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're using the hashtag, for example. I think one example was during the Blackout Tuesday in 2020, where people tagged Black Lives Matter indirectly and they hijacked that hashtag.
Yeah.
And, you know, the hashtag was supposed to be providing information and resources during the protest, you know. So I think for me, like you said, social media, you know, has become a place where people can coordinate, you know, different things. But I think more importantly is that people should leave social media and do something about the issue.
Yeah.
So if it's, for example, this untoward thing we see towards about sexual assault or sexual violence towards women, you know, men need to begin to have those conversations with themselves about what's acceptable to do to a woman or not do to a woman. You know, we need champions offline. Social media is great. Social media activism and social justice is great, but all of those things, you know, will come to nothing if you do not take action offline, you know.
And this point that you've made has, you know, sort of brought to my mind a certain thing that I consider as a phenomenon. And before, obviously, you go on, I wanted to just make the point, which is the fact that obviously people need to get off their phones, foot on ground. So if you look at the way the divide this has created, we have a lot of more educated people, more urban, you know, people who are closer to the, you know, the upper class than the lower class. Essentially, the assumed middle class in Nigeria, if you like. A lot of these sort of people in the past, way back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, up to the 80s in Nigeria and 90s, are the category of people who used to show up to protest issues, to demand social justice for different things. They leave their academia, they leave their seats in different committees, they show up. And the reason why it was so effective that these issues kind of yielded in the past, and mind you, this was during the military. That is why I never subscribed to the, you know, conversations about, oh, our parents or whatever didn't do enough or something. They were fighting a whole different system of government that we won't be able to come out in this day and age. And so these people still managed to come out. And this class of people, a ton of us are now on social media and doing this activism. We need to realize that these are tools. And we also need to realize that beyond the big issue in Nigeria, beyond the big Nigeria issue, which is federal in nature, if you like, we need to remember that the small communities and small circles close to us need presence of people, need presence of voices, and people need to leave their phones, because we have all been, you know, unknowingly programmed to focus on this federal level without understanding that there are people who need our voices in our immediate communities, and we need to show up and speak up for those issues as well. And I say this because somebody always told me, I think a few years ago, he said, if we pay more attention and try to solve the immediate issues in all of our individual places, we would achieve more success and see than all of us focusing at the federal level. And I think this is an approach that should apply whether in Nigeria or anywhere else. And the more, urban, more educated people, more traveled or more read people need to leave their phones and realize that these phones, these platforms are platforms for coordination and reaching out to communities on a larger scale. Yes, but the fight for justice for every one of our neighbors is where we live and with the people that we interact, facially on a daily basis.
Yes, great. And I think this is just an appropriate segue into like our second topic, which is political participation.
Yes.
It's amazing. I mean, what you just said about, people just leaving their phones and just even going to the internal communities. I can bet you there are many people that do not even know what local government area they live in. They reside in. There's a lot of people who don't even know the local government chairman or where they reside in. I was saying to some people, to a group of people I was speaking to a few years ago,
Yes.
about how every 4 years is usually an election cycle in Nigeria. But you see, every 4 years is also every 4 years of your life. What are you doing about your country? So every 4 years, are you just going to make noise, trend a hashtag, say God forbid, are you just going to get involved? It's 4 years out of your life as well. Whatever number of years God has given you on earth, it's 4 years out of it too. So it's important, in my opinion, that everyone has to be, at least for people that are socially or politically conscious,
Yes.
You have to participate in politics. And let me just, political participation is a process through which an individual plays a role in the political life of a society and has the opportunity to take part in deciding what the common goals of those societies are and the best way of achieving those goals. People consider political participation a fundamental requirement of democratic governance. So political participation goes beyond voting in an election. I think there was something, there's some socially conscious group that, sort of have, and one of the things that we say is, look, between politics and governance, there's a lot of stuff that you can do. And I'm just going to read out, it may not mean that, but the point is one.
Yeah.
Either be documenting history as it's happening. You're taking part in that political process. Do you understand?
So
You can.
can you make that point again? Because I think it's a really good point.
So I always say between. So you see, there's a lot. So there's a difference between governance and politics.
Yeah.
Okay. And there's, so between politics and governance, there's a lot of stuff in between. Okay. Now, I mentioned the first one I mentioned was documenting history. So people will say, I'm not the sort of person, I don't like going for all these meetings, they irritate me, people just be talking anyhow, all these people. But you
Yeah.
see, other things that you can do. You can be the sort of person who is always at the ward meetings, taking pictures. You are participating in the political process. You're documenting history for the future. Because I'm one of those people that I like to study. Sometimes I think for a time I was looking for pictures from 1900 about a
Yeah.
certain thing, and I couldn't find any. And that day occurred to me that imagine someone was part of this and had just been documenting just by taking pictures. I would be so grateful to that person because they will make me see things as they happened back then.
Yeah.
Another part is there are people that are community mobilizers. They can go and knock on doors and stuff. I mean, history is replete with a lot of all the female okay, sorry, I'm focusing on female examples. You have
All right,
people like
that's good as well. That's good. We need more female examples, obviously.
you have people like Familiar Ransom Cookie, who they deceived us was the first woman to drive a car, but she was so much more than that.
Yeah.
She was a community mobilizer. So was Gambo Sawaba. She was a rebel. I love her story so much.
Yeah.
You know. So I mean, point is, the people that can't be there physically, but can donate money. That's a form of political participation. You know, they're just all of these different things. And I'm hoping that maybe we'll be able to put that in an image so that we can show people that you don't have to go and, you know, you don't think that it's by attending just ward meetings and stuff that all of those things will happen. But yeah. Let me mention that, you know, you go ahead and then just take the conversation from there.
Yeah, I think I very much like the point that you are making. And I want to also add to that by saying people need to realize that the quest for political power is not the only aspect of political participation.
Yeah.
And you don't just wake up. For me, I'm using myself as an example. I have no interest in political power. I've never, you know, once said I want to, and that I don't wake up with an illusion. I'm guaranteed that I will not wake up with an illusion someday and say I want to contest an election. You get what I mean? Because I know that to contest an election, you need to have been part of, you know, the structures that have been in place for a while. You need to participate. You need to do all these things. But I'm also conscious that within my own immediate environment, I need to engage with, you know, my community, my different this thing. So what I want people to know is that their first step to political participation is actually participation in their community initiatives. So the community in which they exist in, how much of a presence do they have when people are having conversations about the roads that are going to be built, or they're having conversations about children's, situating the schools in those places? How much of a voice do they have about the cleanliness of the slaughterhouses? What do they call those places again? The places where they slaughter animals.
Sheepers.
Yeah. How much of a say do they have? And so for me, this is essentially the first step for political participation. So people need to be present in their own communities. They need to also engage the political structures. So you don't have to be a political member to participate in politics. You just also need, if you might have a different vision, a different goal than political power. In that case, you make sure you're a good community man. And you engage those structures. You engage whoever is presenting himself as a candidate. You people have to be able to speak to those people, have to, you know, engage that process. So I think for me, that's the major thing. The issue we are having is that a lot of young people have grown up with the idea that joining a political party is the only kind of political participation, and we need to deconstruct that. And we need to have people know that participating in politics also means participating in where they live, in the places they live. But also, people cannot wake up and criticize every other person that is participating and then not engage in the process. So that's problematic. If you don't want to, it'll be another issue, and that's fine. But if you are part of a community, part of a, the decision making, you know, in your immediate community, I think that is very important that you engage the process and engage the structures that exist, and also make your voice heard in whatever situation or whatever issue comes up in those places. Yeah, so I think that's it for political participation. I mean, we can speak a lot about this. This is a very broad issue. We can always want to, you know, speak about it. But now I think we want to talk about something a little bit more fun.
Okay.
because you know political party politics is a very serious conversation. So we just move to talking about the economy of Owambe. Sure that this is a topic that Elsa is very excited about.
Yes. So
I'll let her go first.
So for Simi, assuming that we have international audience, we have an international audience, you know, who are not Nigerian and don't understand what Owambe is. So you see, Owambe is like a lavish and flamboyant party thrown by Nigerians, which is usually characterized by a show of luxury, lavish spending, lots of color, lots of food, music, dance, and networking. And it has its origin in Western Nigeria, particularly the Yoruba culture, of which I am from. And also, his wife.
Yeah. You're right, you're right.
Yoruba women, you know, I was looking at images of Mother's Day yesterday, and I noticed that everyone that had a Yoruba mother was dressed to the nines, you know, with color, and didn't matter how old they were, and they had like shoe and bag to match. Wow. I was like, I kept saying, Yoruba women can never be cut off fresh, you know, like they have to never cut off fresh, like they're always looking on point. But you see, I think this thing, you know, growing up, my dad didn't really like it. He was not a fan of women, you know, just this Owambe culture. It just felt like, you know, it was a way for Yoruba people, for my aunties, for example, they'd explain that, oh, people are your covering. So when they're doing any events, whether they're having a naming ceremony or housewarming party, you know, reunions, you had to show up. And then you had to show up in what they call Ashwebi. That's the way you show that. My father didn't understand that. Like, that's stupid. Why are you spending money on things that have no eternal value? Like, can I buy land and build a house? Which one is your Ashwebi up and down? But you see, go ahead.
Yeah, and it reminded me about the famous August wedding movie. I think it trended in Nigeria, you know, I think around the early 2000s. It was a huge movie, and it was among Igbo women, with the way they organized to buy those clothes and wait until it was August. And so I think this paints the picture for me perfectly.
Yeah, so, you know, so, and I think that, I mean, of course, I think that this phenomenon has definitely left Yoruba land. It's all over Nigeria now. And it's become an industry of its own. You know, you have event management firms, you have fashion designers and tailors. Like, I was looking at an outfit on Instagram, and I managed to ask them the price. I was like, okay, I'll come back when I have money and I'm rich and I'm older, because definitely I cannot afford this. You know, they have ushering outfits, their security firms, their musicians, their DJs, event decoration companies, food catering businesses, and they're just different souvenir vendors. You know, just it has become this whole industry.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, you know, you have event centers that now serve as venues for partying, or like before when people just used to use their homes, you know, you have event centers that charge as much as 2 million naira for one day's rental, you know, in places like Lagos and Port Harcourt. You know, the Owambe industry has created employment for a lot of Nigerians, you know, from the That's north right. to the south to the west. But it does put a lot of Nigerians under an unbelievable amount of pressure. You know, everybody wants to outdo the other person. The pressure is placed on the celebrants to provide visitors with a good time. And many times it results in overwhelming financial expenses. You know, attendees too. I mean, these days, I'm not a terrible person, but I usually don't like people inviting me to anything. Like, please, can you not? I mean, thank God for coronavirus now. But before, you now have to think about what you wear. Think about how you, I mean, if they even have like Maybe there's some, maybe the person is very close to you and you're just like, okay, you know what, you do actually be with them. You give it to your tailor that's probably going to charge you. A good tailor will charge you like at least 15 or 20,000. Then you now still look for the shoes to match. And then, because I cannot do makeup to save my life, I have to now get a makeup artist to come and paint my face so that I will not arrive looking like someone's nanny. You know, you spend so much money and there's so much pressure on the attendees too. They have to show up and, you know, it shifts from becoming celebratory to becoming a place where people show off. But let me hear what has been your experience with Oambez?
I think it gives a sort of credence to how informal economies have become very powerful in Nigeria. And Oambe doesn't have any form of structure. It's just something that grew out of people's desire to, you know, enjoy themselves and celebrate their people and also be able to show their own beautiful and colorful outlooks. And this essentially for me is driven by the fine culture that Yoruba people have always had. If you look at a lot of the traditional celebrations, especially the festivities like the Egungun festivals, you would see that people loved to dress up for those kind of occasions. And it seemed to me like that has a lot of influence till this day in how people, you know, show up for Oambez and want to express themselves, want to show their own culture, want to represent their family very well. And this is a very wonderful thing to see. And to the point that you make about the creating of jobs, we've seen a whole, I think, pipeline of entrepreneurs spring up within the continuum of Oambe. We've seen people become just DJs out of nothing, out of the blue, just because there are different ceremonies happening and people need either expensive DJs, cheap DJs, and affordable, you know, just something that people can go by. And people have turned into caterers just for the sake of these Oambez. And I know very much that there are people I know who they finished school, didn't know what to do with their lives because, you know, they didn't find jobs that they love or jobs that they were qualified for, something of that nature. And they've now become full-blown caterers and they make really good money out of it. I think the social pressure part of it is there that you mentioned. But again, if you look at the jobs this has created, I think it's a really good thing. If you also examine the makeup MUA, I don't know what they call it, MUA, there are a lot of young ladies and young men who have become, you know, facial artists. Making people up for these kind of occasions. And weddings have become a sort of social gathering for friends who have not seen each other for a long time. And they're like, I'm going to this person's Oambe. I'm going to show up. And people save money just to buy these dresses, dress in a very colorful and uniform kind of way just to represent themselves as well as be present for their families and friends.
Absolutely. I think it was in 2013, a research company, Euromint, showed how Nigeria had the world's fastest growing rate of champagne consumption, second only to France. It's amazing. I mean, like you said, it's just amazing how much people, how much jobs this has created for that industry. We're talking about makeup artists, you know, and just think, people that even make drinks. I know there's somebody that, you know, she's become like a multimillionaire from just making cocktail drinks for parties. you know, so they're just a whole lot of, you know, it's like I said, people just identify something that's missing and then sort it. I mean, look, think about small chops, for example.
Yeah.
A few years ago, it was never a part of parties, but now you can't be at a party. It's usually like the first thing that you're served before they even bring the other meal. Now, yeah, you know, they're just different options with the stuff. But, you know, for some people, I mean, it's instructive, I'm sorry, to note that, I mean, with COVID-19, that sector has been really affected, and the industry has been really impacted. So think about the event centers, many of them have been shut down. You know, they don't earn money. Well, maybe some of them are borrowed and need to repay the banks and stuff. You know, there's nothing in their contract agreements that would have prepared them for a COVID-19 situation. Yeah. You know, all of these other people, I mean, people with food and drinks, they found a way because, again, Nigerians, very creative. I know that people, when they're having parties over Zoom, they arrange with the vendors, so the vendors go and deliver the food at the individual addresses.
Yeah.
So everybody, you know, in their homes, but through, you know, and then eats together via Zoom or something. You know, so some people are still making, you know, still getting a headway, but some other people, you know, it's been a complete shutdown. But do you have anything else to add?
Yeah, I think that it's important that when COVID, we are able to obviously fight COVID to a still, whether via vaccine or via God's mercy. I think that it's important that people get back on their grind, because these small economies are essentially the power, the cornerstone of, you know, of our country. And this is not just for our country. I think everywhere else, the small businesses are really the mainstay of the large economies. Corporations will be there, big companies will be there, but then small businesses and all these startups and all these kind of, you know, Owambe inspired creatives are the sort of people who the exchange of money between themselves and every other entrepreneur in that space helps keep people's pocket oiled with money to spend. And the more money people spend from their pockets, the more, you know, the next man have something to do. So I think it's really important, it's really vital that we adhere to restrictions or mask wearing or all kinds of safety, so that if our economy returns, we'd have obviously something to return to. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, I think now we'll pivot to obviously a fire questions for the day, which is where I think you have something to say. All right then, let's. I don't know why you always try to obstruct fire questions. Let's do fire questions then. I have some for you.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. all right, here we go. I'm saying that because last week you obstructed fire questions and reminded us of the need to talk about something else. So.
No, I was.
Because you wanted to talk about Meghan Markle and Harry. Please don't start. Don't start. Let's just go into fire questions. I don't have that many today, but I think I can do with this. And I'll start by asking you, rainy or dry season as a Nigerian?
Oh my God. Neither.
That was taking too long. So you don't like rainy season, I don't like dry season. What do you, what's your weather preference in Nigeria?
Stable. Not hot, not cold.
You prefer not to be hot and not to be cold.
Temperature, please.
I see why you like Abuja now, but these days it's getting a lot warmer in Abuja. Headphones or earpiece?
If it's Bang and Olufsen, headphones.
Oh goodness.
Okay. Headphones.
New York or London? You don't like the fast life? Abuja.
Yes, New York.
Okay. In terms of being romantic, letters or emails?
Well, in romance, handwritten letters. Yes. I'm a lover of handwritten things.
I just pray you haven't or don't encounter bad handwritings.
Yeah, you mentioned it. Huh. You don't have to have this fellow write me something. Actually, and that can be a deal breaker.
If the handwriting is atrocious, then there's problem.
Probably.
If it looks like mine, there's problem. There's problem.
Do you have one of those doctor handwritings, Bob?
No, it's not that bad, but it's not great. Flowers or chocolates?
Flowers.
That's staying with romance for a bit. Movies or eating out? On a date night.
I don't know. To be honest, I don't know. I like both activity. Eating out once in a while. Movies forever. Whether we're watching a laptop or the cinema is fine.
Yeah. Okay. Flats or heels?
Heels.
Why? Looks like so much work. Yeah.
It is a lot, but you see, but there are different types of heels. There's 1 inch, there's 2 inch, there's 3 inch. So depending on the outfit, you know, they can choose your inches. But I think that heels just give a, you know, Grace Kelly, classy kind of vibe to your outfit.
Yeah.
Even though I just like, you know, that's business and I wear my flats. But yeah, usually if I'm trying to, and then, as a Yoruba girl, I cannot be cut on fresh. So, most times I'm wearing heels.
Well, that's
some measure.
That's really interesting. I don't know which you did, but boarding houses or day?
Oh, boarding.
Boarding?
Yes.
Whoa. We never would have been friends back then.
Why?
I hate boarding schools. I've always hated boarding schools.
I think that I went to the exceptions. So when people are narrating someone's, I honestly cannot relate. My boarding school, we see it like 5 times a day.
Wow. I would have taken that boarding school though. Yeah, I broke the chain of boarding schools in my house. I did, because I think Nigerian boarding schools are, for yours that you attended, but I don't think I would.
All the stories I've heard are terrible.
Yeah. So, this brings us to the end of this.
I have my own question.
Oh, you do? Fantastic. I thought you didn't, because for a minute there, it was looking like you were not going to say anything. So shoot.
Yeah, but I just have like very few questions. So beans or porridge?
Wow. So you, by porridge, you mean porridge yam?
Yes, yam porridge, yes.
I prefer yam porridge, obviously, to beans if I'm eating out. But if I'm eating in the house, I prefer to eat beans to yam porridge. But I like both of them. But I don't remember eating beans outside of my house before. Like, never. It's one food that I only eat in my house.
Makes sense. So Abuja or Lagos?
Infinitely Abuja. Like forever. Forever.
Okay. Digital drawing or normal painting?
I think normal painting. And I'll tell you something. This is, I hope my wife isn't hearing me from, you know, from her room, but she paints. And yeah, I've seen her paint really amazing stuff. So I live with a very talented person.
Aww. See, my sister. So cute. Then, okay, so Dublin or New York?
Whoa.
I got to there too.
You know, New York is very fast-paced. I love Dublin, right? It's very calm. It's my Abuja city, you get. But also, it rains a lot. It rains a lot. I don't know if it rains as much in New York. I don't think it does. So I definitely want to go with New York here, but then I don't like fast cities. So that's the only thing discouraging me from choosing New York. But yeah, so Dublin it is. And Dublin is actually a really nice place. It's very traditional, it's beautiful, it's colorful, it's very diverse. You literally will see this diversity on the streets, you know.
Okay.
And Dublin has this scenery of really amazing, like, cafes, you know, really artsy places on the road, bookstores, just, yeah.
Okay. That's great. I think that's all I have for you today.
Awesome. That's really nice. It made me think about, obviously, not wanting to live in cities that are always ahead of time, like Lagos and New York. Well, thank you very much for, obviously, what's been a wonderful episode. And I hope that everyone that's listening also enjoy it as much as we do when talking about these things. For all the people who gave us feedback last week, for the last episode, thank you. That's wonderful. Thank you for listening. And we hope that you keep listening as well.
Yeah. From me, signing out till next week. Have a great, great week. And yeah, don't forget to drink lots of water.
Yeah, that's a great advice. All right. And thank you. Bye.